This is part of our national infrastructure in terms of our ability to exert influence and sovereignty in the Arctic domain.
The Coast Guard calls for a bigger budget to buy an icebreaker. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Army unit charged with flying supplies into Denali Base Camp.
We have like a letter. We have a letter of permission from Post Cereal to call ourselves the Sugar Bears.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
The head of the Coast Guard says the country must invest in new icebreakers to meet a predicted increase in Arctic drilling and marine traffic. But he also told a U.S. Senate panel today the Coast Guard needs a lot of ships, and icebreakers aren't the top item on his acquisitions list. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Can two ships be called a fleet? If so, that's the size of the Coast Guard's icebreaking fleet, plus one more that's in the shop and may never return to service. Still, Coast Guard Commandant Paul Zunkoft says he has so few multipurpose cutters that the Coast Guard can only stop 20% of the known drug shipments in the Caribbean and Pacific. The Admiral says that allows international crime, terrorism, and human trafficking to flourish with relative impunity.
With our limited arsenal of ships and aircraft, this is truly an issue of capacity. And this is why the offshore patrol cutter is my number one recapitalization priority.
The Coast Guard procurement plan adds 91 new ships to replace an old cutter fleet that's prone to time-sucking breakdowns. Total cost, more than $21 billion. The Commandant says if the Coast Guard is going to build icebreakers too, he's going to need a bigger budget. Zunkoff calls it a good investment.
This is part of our national infrastructure, if you will, in terms of our ability to exert influence and sovereignty in the Arctic domain.
Some in Congress have pressed the U.S. Navy to chip in for a new billion-dollar icebreaker. But a Navy official balked last month, telling a House panel the service has its own shipbuilding needs. Senator Dan Sullivan of Alaska chaired the Senate hearing. Sullivan says everyone seems to recognize the need for more icebreakers, but paying for it seems to be a matter of political football.
You know, clearly the Russians in this area are eating our lunch, despite as you, what you mentioned is a country whose size in terms of the economy is well below that of the United States.
Russia is said to have 40 icebreakers. Of those in operation, four are in the heavy-duty class. About half the Russian fleet is medium and small icebreakers that are privately owned. While many of Moscow's ships are reaching the end of their expected lifespan, that country has 11 new icebreakers planned or under construction. Zunkoff says he's still cooperating with his Russian counterparts, so those Russian ships should be considered assets that might be called on to respond to an American search and rescue case.
As we look at what are the real threats as we see in the Arctic, think beyond Vladimir Putin, and the real threats are continue to be safety of life at sea, environmental, the well-being of the indigenous tribes that have lived up in the Arctic region for the millennium.
In the near term, despite the lack of a U.S. Coast Guard port in the Arctic, Zunkoff says they are preparing for the likelihood that Shell will resume exploratory drilling in the Chukchi Sea this year.
And we will have a rotational presence of the Coast Guard cutter Healy, a national security cutter, and a shore-based aviation detachment based in the Arctic region this summer.
The Commandant also addressed Alaskan concerns that the seven island-class patrol cutters, now based in Southeast and the Gulf of Alaska, will be replaced by six fast-response cutters. Yes, Alaska would lose a patrol boat, but Zunkoff says the new cutters will be able to operate over more days in harsher conditions and travel further from home. For APRN, I'm Liz Ruskin.
immediately after the legislature gaveled out of their extended regular session, Governor Bill Walker called them back for a special one. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
On Tuesday morning, lawmakers, some reluctantly, some bedraggled, and some remarkably chipper, reconvened at 10 a.m. for two separate five-minute floor sessions. They received a message from the governor asking them to do three things: expand Medicaid, create a sexual abuse prevention program for schools, and pass a budget that pays for government for a whole year. Lawmakers then broke up into a series of closed-door meetings. There were caucus meetings, leadership meetings, and meetings with the governor. House Speaker Mike Chenault said he broached the idea of taking a two-week recess and then reconvening back in Anchorage, noting that construction is scheduled to start on the Capitol building in a matter of days. As all of that was happening, Walker's new budget dropped. It reverses the legislature's freeze on cost of living raises for public employees. It restores some money for education, but still includes his original cut of $32 million in one-time funding for schools. And predictably, it also includes language that lets the state accept federal dollars to expand Alaska's Medicaid program. In all, it adds $90 million in state spending that had been cut by the legislature. His budget also requires a draw from the Constitutional Budget Reserve, the hard-to-access rainy day fund responsible for a stalemate in the first place. The House Finance Committee is scheduled to hear that budget bill on Wednesday. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
On the day the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments on marriage equality, more than 40 people gathered at the Diamond Courthouse Plaza across from the state capitol in Juneau to rally through song and dance. The group wants Governor Bill Walker and Attorney General Craig Richards to end Alaska's same-sex marriage appeal in one federal case and withdraw its support of gay marriage bans in the Supreme Court case. One of the event organizers, Maureen Longworth, recited her version of the song's lyrics.
Governor Walker, I'm aware of what you do. After we voted for you, you signed on the amicus brief against marriage equality. There's time before you spend money causing us pain and hurt. Think it over. We gave our trust to you.
Through a spokesperson, the governor says he respects the separation of power from the attorney general. The issue of withdrawing the state's same-sex marriage appeal or from the brief is up to the attorney general. Assistant Attorney General Corey Mills says the Department of Law doesn't plan on withdrawing from either. In January, the Walker administration asked to hold the appeal. Mills says it's prudent to wait for the Supreme Court decision. There have been 134 same-sex marriages in Alaska since it became legal on October 14th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, life with the honey bucket in rural Alaska.
When the springtime comes, it's really gross and smelly.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com.
In the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, the three Western Alaska Alcohol and Narcotics Task Force investigators can't be everywhere at once. Some villages are trying to fill in gaps where bootlegged alcohol reaches dry option communities. In the second of a three-part series on the law enforcement efforts to stem the flow of alcohol to the region, KYUK's Ben Matheson reports on Akiak's tribal approach.
On a bright spring day overlooking the frozen Kuskokwim River, Akiak Tribal Policeman Ryan Jackson explains how a low-tech checkpoint works. It's intended to stop alcohol at the doorstep of the community. It's basically Jackson, a four-wheeler, and his badge.
I just hold it up and say, stop. This is a checkpoint.
For the past two winters, the village has set up a checkpoint where snow machines and trucks come in off the river. Jackson and others make sure to have coverage for big traffic days like basketball tournaments and dog races, as well as payday for local employers. When the community is flush with cash, that's when they know people will make the trip to Bethel, coming back with alcohol, which fetches $80 a bottle in Akiak. The checkpoint's not in operation this day. Jackson says the methods change depending on the conditions.
Four-wheeler, snow-go, truck, either one, doesn't matter. Snow-go is easy to chase with those.
That is, if someone flees.
You chase after them.
Leaders say they've seized 500 bottles coming into Akiak this past winter. An agreement with nearby Akiachuk, Tuluksak, and Kweethluk allows for similar efforts. Mike Williams, a tribal advocate, alcohol counselor, and dog musher, says the matter is extremely personal to him. He's lost his six brothers to alcohol.
It's a small community. We know who brings in booze and we know who bootlegs. When a person brings in that booze from the next village with today's technology of instant communication with texting and everything, we know who's dealing.
Tragedy was evident this winter when three Akiak people who had been drinking drove their four-wheelers through a storm into an open hole on the Kuskokwim and drowned. Surrounded by millions of acres of tundra, back trails, and side sloughs, Akiak's not going to catch every last bottle. William says bootleggers know that as well as anyone.
They've been getting real smart, too. They've been doing transactions 2-3 miles outside of Akiak.
For Williams, taking an aggressive stance in the village is part of a broad push to regain local tribal control after legislation fractured jurisdiction. Williams says it's prevented tribes from having meaningful power at home.
We've lost so much control over the long years, but we need to have that control back and take our lives back.
While they're happy to share information with troopers, Akiak takes a distinctly tribal approach to follow up with those caught bootlegging. They're brought in front of tribal court judges like 72-year-old Elizabeth Lake.
It's good to have somebody talk to them in the village instead of having troopers come around.
Lake says people caught running alcohol may face fines or community service, but keeping them out of jail and closer to home helps in the long run. Jackson Williams is another tribal court judge.
We're the community that want to really go after people that do bootlick, that bring in booze, you know, and to sell. We take care of it our way.
And that way is bound to raise privacy concerns regarding the checkpoints. But Williams takes a broader perspective.
When we first started that, people were saying, what about my civil rights? What about my rights as an individual? And we say, what about the rights of our children? What about the rights of our women? What about the rights of our, being a healthy community? What about those people that are not using that are being affected? What are their rights?
State law enforcement doesn't get involved. Investigator Todd Mooring from the state's Western Alaska Alcohol and Narcotics Team says the checkpoint is a strictly tribal initiative.
I applaud their efforts. They're doing a great job out there trying to take an active role in combating the bootlegging out there, which has just been really good. I mean, it's really cut down on the volume of calls we've received from Akiak because they have been stepping it up. They've been processing a lot of things tribally.
Chance Cunningham worked as a village public safety officer in Akiak for 2 years. He says his role at the checkpoint was to stand by.
So I generally sat either in the truck or, you know, off in a far-off distance in the shadows in hopes that nothing bad happened where I could be there because I have the tools and the training.
Back on the front lines, TPO Jackson thinks it's working.
Less work if we get the bottles before they go out.
And to keep the bottles from entering his community, Jackson will stand watch where the Kuskokwim meets the village. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
More than 6% of Alaskans live without water or sewer systems. The so-called honey bucket is a third world solution, and millions of federal and state dollars have been devoted to changing it. But people in 3,300 households in the state live without running water and flush toilets and have much higher rates of hospitalization for respiratory and skin infections. Today, we begin a five-part series from KNBA's Jocelyn Estes entitled Kick the Bucket, in which we'll get a closer look at the water and sewer systems in rural Alaskan communities. Part one looks at the public health implications of inadequate water supplies.
If you're one of Queethluk's 750 residents, you're 400 miles from the road system that serves Anchorage and Fairbanks, 120 miles from the Bering Sea, and live near a branch of the Kuskokwim River. In the winter, this is how you get water for your household.
You have to chip the ice away. You have to chip, and especially when it was really cold and the ice was thick.
Until Claudia Hansen's home gets hooked up to a new piped water and sewer system, her son continues to haul ice from the Queethluk River. Once it melts and the silt settles, it's ready to use and drink. 50 miles up the Kuskokwim River in Tuntutuliak, Lucy Loopy says fetching water is a young man's job.
Since my husband is getting older, it is harder for him to get ice.
Alaskans without plumbing also collect rainwater or buy water at a central watering point, often carrying home 5-gallon jugs weighing about 40 pounds each. After all that effort, people use water sparingly, as little as 2 gallons per person per day. 15 gallons a day is considered necessary to stay clean, and the average American uses 80 to 100 gallons of water a day. One way villagers conserve water is by sharing a basin of soapy water for hand washing. Especially for little ones, this can foster respiratory infections, as Kivalina Community Health Aide Isabel Booth explains.
A lot of respiratory illness. We've had a lot of pneumonia and bronchiolitis in like 2 and under.
CDC studies show Alaskans without plumbing get invasive pneumococcal infections up to 11 times more often than other Alaskans. In southwest Alaska, where 40% of the homes lack plumbing, 1 in 4 infants is hospitalized for severe respiratory infection. In northwest Alaska, Kivalina gets its water from a river and sometimes can't get enough to last all year. Booth says she sees the effects when the water tanks are closed.
Every time when they shut down, I start to see abscess, skin problems like abscess start.
When people can't use outhouses due to permafrost or boggy ground, for instance, they use a bucket fitted with a toilet seat, a honey bucket, which gets emptied every day or so. In Tuntutuliak, Adolf Loopy carries his family honey bucket down a boardwalk leading to an underground bunker. He advises caution.
Make sure it's not slippery around here. Or we'll slip in the honey bucket will be over us.
Back indoors, Loopy says it's worse when it's warmer.
When the springtime comes, it's really gross and smelly.
People are frustrated, but most say they wouldn't move just to have plumbing. Many villagers have strong ties, like Lucy Loopy, who says she doesn't know who she would socialize with in larger communities.
It's where our relatives are. Like, if I was in the city, where would I turn to for help or even to socialize.
And many rural communities have thrived for centuries because they're ideally situated for food gathering. Stanley Hawley of Kivalina says he's driven by the imperative and rewards of supporting his family with food from nature.
Once we get exposed to that
livelihood, that way of living. It gets ingrained in our spirit and in our soul and in our psyche.
Health experts say near universal piped water and sewer is one of, if not the most important American public health achievement of the 20th century. It helped cut U.S. mortality rates by 40% and raise life expectancy from 47 to 63 years. Later, we'll hear about some of the reasons so many Alaskans still live without plumbing. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
On Alaska, we'll get a big population boost this weekend with the first cruise ship of what's shaping up to be a busy summer. The Aleutian Islands usually see a ferry run before the cruise ships start coming, but not this year. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has more.
On Sunday, the 781-foot Crystal Symphony will offload the most passengers in Alaska's ever seen, around 1,000 people, as many as a quarter of the town's residents. Normally, the state ferry marks the start of summer in the Aleutians, but this year, the aging ferry Testamina is in shipyard for repairs until mid-May, and state budget cuts could mean fewer sailings overall after that. On Alaska Visitors Bureau Director Kathy Jordan says a shorter ferry season will have a big impact on the Aleutian chain for tourists and residents alike.
A lot of people like to come out on the ferry, stay for a day or two, maybe fly back on the Alaska Air, or they'll take the ferry back the same day. But also important for the chain is for the other smaller communities that get on the ferry along the way and come out here and shop and then bring goods back to their hometown. And that also impacts our businesses.
But she's hoping more cruise ships might help fill the gap. 2015 will be on Alaska's longest, busiest cruise season ever. The Crystal Symphony is the first of 8 ships with scheduled stops. One in September will bring 2,000 passengers to town.
I'm a little concerned about how we are going to be able to accommodate that many people on the island for that amount of time. They don't always all disembark. So, you know, hopefully we'll be able to scatter them throughout the island at one time. You know, our tourist destinations can't hold, you know, but 150, 200 people. So we'll try to keep them busy with some other alternatives.
She's calling in extra buses and working with the town's few restaurants and museums to organize special events. She'll also have volunteers on hand to help guide explorers. Jordan says that small town feel is one advantage Unalaska has over bigger ports.
I've seen many people stop and talk to cruise ship passengers and give directions or give an idea of what to do next. Or even the birders, when we have a group of birders in from a cruise ship, they'll ask, where can I find this bird? And I've seen local people, oh, go down this road and take a right, you know, so it's really great.
Of course, on Alaska's main draw is as a fuel stop. It's the first big port of call for ships crossing the Pacific from Asia. The Crystal Symphony is one of those. It's en route from Tokyo to Vancouver, with stops in Kodiak, Seward, and Ketchikan after it leaves the Aleutians. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Army helicopters flew the last round of supplies to Denali Base Camp yesterday for the 2015 climbing season. The unit, dubbed the Sugar Bears, is well known in Talkeetna and has a history in Alaska of combining training and supply runs. KTNA's Philip Manning went along on the flight.
There are signs all around of the imminent beginning of Denali climbing season. The temperature is warming, the mosquitoes are back, and the sugar bears are in town. Sugar Bears is the nickname of the U.S. Army's 1st Battalion 52nd Aviation Regiment's Bravo Company, based at Fort Wainwright. If the name conjures up images of breakfast cereal, there's a good reason.
Mm-mm. My Super Golden Crisp cereal with 8 vitamins makes this nutritious breakfast really neat.
That's from an advertisement for Golden Crisp, which was also called Sugar Crisp, and the mascot is the appropriately named Sugar Bear. Chief Warrant Officer Kirk Donovan says Bravo Company's name originated from supply runs that the unit made after relocating to Alaska following Vietnam.
They first come up to Alaska, they used to haul in a lot of supplies to a lot of these real remote areas, a lot of these real remote villages, and they actually used to bring in like General Mills cereal.
Presumably, they also brought a lot of Post cereal, the company that made Sugar Crisp. Chief Warrant Officer Malcolm Jennings says the unit has official permission to use the Sugar Bear mascot.
We have like a letter, we have a letter of permission from Post cereal to call ourselves the Sugar Bears.
Despite the frankly adorable image that the unit's name conjures, the 152nd Bravo Company is an Army unit like many others. For the last few days, they've been taking loads of supplies from Talkeetna to support the National Park Service's presence on Denali. That's far from their only role, however. The unit returned from deployment to Afghanistan late last year, and a soldier showed me where on the helicopter guns could be mounted. Lieutenant Colonel Alan Brown, a U.S. Army Alaska spokesman, says the Sugar Bears are training again now that they're back in the U.S.
So they've been working to get their aircraft back from deployment, get them all refitted and up to operating speed, and so they're going to have a busy summer.
Lieutenant Colonel Brown says part of that training means not only the type of terrain the soldiers operate on, but also preparing for the variety of entities that they might have to work with.
And so this kind of training gives us the ability to train all over the region. Not only at that high altitude in this mountainous terrain, but also really kind of doing a lot of the collaboration with different agencies.
The vehicle of choice for the Sugar Bears and their missions is the CH-47 Fox Chinook helicopter. With nearly 10,000 horsepower, a cargo capacity of 10 tons, and a top speed approaching 200 miles per hour, the Chinook is ideal for the kind of supply mission that Monday's flight called for. With this year's base camp supply runs complete, the Sugar Bears will move on to other training missions until they're needed elsewhere. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu in Juneau, Ben Matheson in Akiak, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Earn a Master of Public Administration from the University of Alaska Southeast online on your schedule while having the structure of the classroom and the accessibility of e-learning. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS. Alaska Pacific University emphasizes teaching and research that engages the region's social, cultural, environmental, and geopolitical issues. The university's Early Honors Program attracts academically advanced high school students who complete their senior year credits while also earning college credits as full-time APU students. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.